Timeless presents Can Women Have It All? This discussion will explore how women can navigate the difficult and often conflicting pressures they face in relation to work and relationships against a backdrop of declining fertility and choices about motherhood. Is having it all an irresponsible myth or the great challenge of equality? Does egg freezing help us take control over this balancing act? Or does it divert attention from the wider systematic changes that might make for a more equitable society? With panelist Professor Geeta Nargand, Medical Director of Create Fertility Clinics. Kylie Baldwin, a medical sociologist with the Reproduction Research Group at De Montfort University. And Sophie Humphreys, Chief Executive of PAWS. The panel is chaired by Melanie Howard, founder of Future Foundation and a Women's Equality Party candidate for the 2016 elections. Timeless presents, Can Women Have It All?
So welcome to Can Women Have It All? This Timeless project, I think, is a really excellent starting point for a really good debate about the reality, role and future of egg freezing in a wider social context and thinking about the way in which women can best manage their lives. It's raising so many questions. I think it's incredibly witty. It's futuristic and it's been beautifully put together. And I hope you've all had a bit of a chance to look at some of the products. It's obviously a fictional beauty brand from the future that is talking to us now about all of the challenges and difficulties that women might face in balancing different aspects of their lives. So thank you to the Liminal Space and obviously to their sponsors, Wellcome and the LSE. So we're going to hear from these three very august panellists in a minute. They're a brilliant bunch and we're really lucky to have them. I suppose from my perspective, and I'm going to give myself 3 minutes now, from my perspective, the having it all myth really became popularised in the 1990s, which was, as some people would describe, the third wave of feminism. Arguably we're now in the fourth, sort of going beyond the fourth and into the fifth. And that sort of brought together the sort of social revolution of the 60s and 70s around self-expression and fulfilment, the desire that we made the most of ourselves and were more liberal about how we experienced ourselves, with the Thatcher philosophy of the 80s, which was all about individualism and self-determination. And I did a study in 1997 with the think tank Demos in the height of the New Labour days, which was called Tomorrow's Women. And we identified even then, and this was when sort of having it all was really kind of fashionable and at its pitch, that only a privileged minority, a very small cadre of educated, highly driven women could indeed succeed within the workplace at the time. And rather interestingly, I think in some ways, the fact that they could do it along the sort of individualised lines of sort of actually being able to organise their lives almost counterintuitively reinforced the status quo, because people running organisations and in government could point, as they did, to Margaret Thatcher, saying, well, there you go, she's made it to the top, can't everybody else? And 20 years on, I suppose, the fact that we're still discussing it and it's still a fashionable topic in the women's magazines and sort of more wider debates just really shows the power of this, I would almost call it a fantasy, or if you like, an ideal sort of dream that we might have about our lives, that we're still chasing after this idea of actually being able to have everything in our lives sort of at the same time beautifully balanced. But I think the Women's Equality Party is really about the, if not the impatience, but for a lot of people, the anger at the slowness with which the world has changed to enable women to balance the caring demands upon them with their desire to achieve career success and all of the other things that we have to struggle with, such as unequal pay, where stubbornly is still almost 20% less than men are paid. But also the widespread stereotyping that we all have to live under, men and women, in our society, which is so unhelpful. So I think the fact that Women's Equality has already got 50,000 members and increasingly getting their sort of policy points across, it's non-partisan, but just trying to actually begin to address the issues that I think are at the heart of this debate as well. And I suppose part of what we want to hear about is how do we make the world a better place so that people can at least begin to balance different aspects of their lives. So I think that egg freezing, we don't have, either myself as Future Foundation or as the Women's Equality Party, can have a definitive answer. It's such a new topic. But it's certainly both a potential advance, but it could also be a reflection of a failure of changing the world and the systemic change that we might need in order to have more women, a growing proportion of women, being able to balance different aspects of their life whilst being economically active, determining their own future and indeed providing care for their children and families. So that's my opener, and I'm now going to hand over to Kylie, who's going to give us 5 minutes of her view.
As you were told in the introduction, I have been working in the field of egg freezing for about 5 years now, and as part of my work, I interviewed 31 women who'd frozen their eggs for social reasons. And kind of during this time, I'd hear very frequently this idea that egg freezing was going to be as revolutionary for women as a contraceptive pill, that it was going to allow women or help women to kind of have it all, and that it was going to allow women to have kind of greater control over their timing of motherhood and greater control over reproductive timing. Excuse me. However, I actually suggest this framing of egg freezing in such a way is actually not only kind of quite erroneous, but perhaps damaging to women potentially. So I think even if we kind of put to one side issues of, you know, how much the technology costs, and it's quite a hefty price tag, as I think people might be talking about later, but some of the risks as well, if we put these issues aside and think about only some women being able to access this technology, this still kind of very much sidesteps the wider concerns, which I think are really important. The fact is the issues that there are so many other things that influence women's reproductive timing, things such as, you know, economic, structural, relational constraints that influence when women, if at all, you know, want to pursue motherhood. And this kind of egg freezing as a technology kind of very much sidesteps this, is my argument as such. You think about how much money it takes to kind of establish oneself, you know, the growing cost of living in places such as London, the fact that more women are going to university, pursuing higher degrees, all these things women are kind of want to get under their belts as such before they pursue motherhood. And all these factors are behind kind of the advanced age that some women are pursuing motherhood for the first time. So if we add into this fears about kind of pursuing motherhood alongside a demanding career, concerns about when a woman should want to become a mother, then it's easy to see why women are concerned about the timing of motherhood as this being kind of quite a pressurised issue. And whilst we're, you know, forums such as these are beginning to recognise the structural and economic constraints on women's reproductive timing, things such as the high cost of living, for example, what isn't being recognised in some of these debates, I suggest, is the role of men in all of this, really. So for the women I interviewed, it wasn't concerns about their career which led them to freeze their eggs, but was very much about the concerns about it not being yet the right time for them to pursue motherhood. And this was very often, in fact in all cases, linked to the fact they weren't in a relationship with a man who they felt was the right man or the right person to have a child with. And this was really the most important thing to these women, that they were in a committed relationship with a male partner who was equally committed to becoming a parent as they were, and who would embrace parenthood, all the kind of the pleasures and pains that brings alongside them. But in the women I spoke to time and time again, they would tell me about how hard and how difficult they had experienced trying to find this perfect man, they would kind of talk about, and about how the men they had met would be often unwilling to settle down, and how this had actually led to relationship breakdown with their partners, fiancés, and even husbands. And for these women, they were kind of encountering this kind of negative double standard in reproductive aging, which meant that their male partners or potential partners could go on having children in their 50s and 60s with relative safety, whereas these women need to have kind of completed their completed their family by their early 40s. And these women I spoke to were talking to me about how actually this double standard in reproductive aging would work against them in the dating market, where men would be able to kind of quite easily meet all other women who are not under the similar kind of time constraints with regards to their fertility through the use of a plethora of dating apps people carry around in their pockets on their phones. And so the problem with social egg freezing, amongst some other issues as well, is kind of, I do recognise the benefits and the wonders that egg freezing can offer, but my concern is that egg freezing doesn't really address men's attitudes towards fatherhood or the timing of parenthood. It doesn't do anything to address some of the conflicting messages women receive about when you should become a mother. that you should do it when you've got your career, you've finished your degree, you've bought your own home, and that you've settled down, you've experienced life as kind of a child-free adult, and that you then give that up in order to pursue motherhood. And I think perhaps we even need to think about very much reframing, we even talk about parenthood as being something which kind of immediately kind of constitutes some kind of loss. However, my biggest problem with egg freezing is how I see it selling women false hope, and selling them what is only an illusion of reproductive choice, given how the technology really is far from guaranteed at this moment in time. The idea that you can freeze your eggs to have children later on in life, I argue, very much further positions the timing of motherhood and these reproductive decisions squarely on women's shoulders, with little regard for the constellation of different social, economic, relational factors that we know underpin this decision. And it doesn't help when organisations that are selling egg freezing include kind of pseudo-empowering taglines, things such as smart women freeze, or as I saw most recently, a message sent out to women that it's the most, to quote, uber-responsible and really smart thing to do. These messages, I suggest, just reinforce that it's women who have to take responsibility for their fertility and the timing of pregnancy in ways which completely is unfair to both men and women by overlooking the role of men as kind of creating families.
Over to you, Gita.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah and Melanie, and thank you for being here. With Mother's Day tomorrow and International Women's Day next Tuesday, and Easter around the corner, we couldn't have chosen a better time to celebrate women, to talk about women and eggs. So clearly it's the right moment, and I would like to talk about that. It is almost 4 years since Anne-Marie Slaughter, who was the first woman director for policy department at the US State Department, declared that I strongly believe that women can have it all, but not today. And I'd like to declare to you today that today has come. Women have every right to have an outstanding career and a fulfilling family life and home life. And when it comes to reproductive choices and reproductive autonomy for women are fundamental to women's rights. And women's rights are human rights, and gender equality is human equality. But gender and nature has created gender inequality when it comes to reproductive aging. We can't take that away from women's eggs. If you look at that, clearly that's not what happens to men, okay? What happens to women with their aging, I mean, there are a finite number of eggs, we lose eggs, we use them, and the quality declines, the quantity declines fairly sharply, and we can't get them back unless we use egg freezing. So egg freezing is here to deal with nature-created gender inequality. And just a few words about egg freezing. Egg freezing, the first egg freezing baby was born in 1986. So we are 30 years down the line, and it's time we talk about it, it's time we raise awareness about it, because egg freezing has been made safe, because we now have safer modern protocols, stimulation protocols, where we have eliminated the risks of ovarian hyperstimulation, which was one of the serious risks. And for that, we have to remove that suppress boxes there. So it's actually fitted in a woman's natural cycle, the stimulation, and we can prevent overstimulation risks. And it's been made successful, and success is real, success is international, success is here. Women, age of the egg matters, of course. Women who are under 35, if they freeze 12 eggs, there's a 50% chance of having a live birth later in life, and the game changer is the fast freezing, vitrification. That's been the game changer. So it's been made safe, it's been made successful, and now the cost. Of course, we've got to bring down the cost, because if we don't bring down the cost, then we will be creating a social inequality. And what we don't want is to create further inequality when we are addressing inequality. So from an egg freezing point of view, it is here to stay, and we need to increase awareness for women who are not ready to have children. And the most common cause is not having a partner, and no government is going to fix that. No policy will fix that. Women need to make that decision themselves if they want to have genetic motherhood. So I oppose the term social egg freezing. It degrades the reason why a woman makes the decision to freeze, to a wish rather than the need. And it's like, what is social? I looked up the definition. The social as an adjective is, it relates to activities in which you meet and spend time with other people when you're not working. That's not social egg freezing, it degrades that. Okay, what I would use the word is age banking. Age stands for anticipated gamete exhaustion, which is what it is, or self-donation. Women are keeping eggs to donate for themselves, and it removes the need for egg donors, it removes the concerns about donor-conceived children and the concerns about donors themselves, and reduces miscarriages and all that. So there is a scientific case and a social and economic case to be made for egg freezing. And we talk about egg freezing, we're here today. No one talks about sperm freezing. Men are freezing sperm for convenience because they are going away or there are work-related issues. But we don't talk about men freezing sperm, but we seem to take egg freezing for women quite differently. So the technological solution must be taken to address social inequality. They must go hand in hand. We do not have to wait for the society to change to offer women what they need to have it all at the right time. They need to go hand in hand. So the technological solution is here. So egg freezing is as important as the pill when it comes to giving women reproductive choice. And I think it is quite important. Of course, it goes without saying that we need to change the workplace, we need to change culture, we need to bring equal play, we need to change policies at the government level. And of course, one of the reasons why we are saying this is because there are guarantees we want. We want paternity leave, we want men to re-socialize, we want men to help women to achieve gender equality. I am behind the He for She campaign, which the UN women set up and is doing extremely well. So therefore, what I would say to you is, egg freezing is here. Egg freezing has been made safer. Egg freezing has been made successful. We need to look beyond our borders for success. The UK HFA published data is not real, it's biased. It takes old social slow freezing techniques into account. Until the UK produces clean, reliable data, we have to look beyond our borders for results, which is something we should be publishing in some years. And I am somebody who would be eventually making a case for public funding for egg freezing. And there's a huge case to be made for gender equality as well as for economic, for a progressive economy of the nation to make that case either for full or partial funding in the future. So thank you for coming. Let us not deny women of the opportunity to freeze eggs and to put their fertility on ice and to achieve gender equality, because it is allowing us to bring us a step closer to gender equality. And let's use that and let's help women have it all. Thank you.
Acts to follow, including Melanie at the beginning, so I will do my best. And I suppose what I want to do first, and Melanie explained my sort of background, I'll talk a bit more about that, but I actually want to acknowledge that it's clearly a very important debate. It's also a very interesting debate. And it clearly gets people quite heated about it, I'm sure, from many different aspects. So thinking about the question today, which was, can women have it all? And I was thinking, why they asked me to be here? I don't actually have a very specific position on this about egg freezing, but I think it's because I actually come from quite a different perspective, and I'm actually going to talk about a different perspective. I run an organisation that works with women who have numerous children. Thousands of children, actually. There are now, today, 70,000 children who are in care at this point. Nearly half of those will come from women who have had more than one child removed. And when we're talking about having it all, and the women I work with, they're very, very vulnerable, they have very complex lives, which I'll explain a bit more about in a moment. And we try and work with them, probably less to try and have it all, but just to try and have, can they have a little bit of it? So I suppose there's a very different way that we can look at that. And we ask them to pause, which is the name of the organisation that I run. And that's actually to spend some time where they're not caught in this cycle of having child after child that ends up being removed, but actually where they use that space. So it is about freezing, because it's freezing time so they can do something different with their lives. And actually, as women, concentrate on other aspects of who they are, not just in relation to their maternal identity. So we look at the things that perhaps a lot of this discussion is about whether women can have careers and have things at the same time. How can they have those optimum times that not jeopardise their fertility or not jeopardise their chance of having a good relationship? With our women, we're looking at, can they just have some aspiration? Can they have an opportunity to have some of those aspects of things that they missed out on, education, parenting, foundations that I'm not saying everybody in this room has, but probably most of us are relatively lucky to have pretty good starts in life, so we're able to move on in a way that we can make, you know, choices. And I think a lot of what today about is about choices. And I was thinking, what's the commonalities though between that? Because it doesn't mean just because the women I work with maybe are in a very different point in the spectrum than the women perhaps we're talking about at the moment, it doesn't mean that one should therefore negate the other. But it's just trying to see that in the whole picture. And actually, it is about control. Both are about women being able to have an element of control, or hopefully total control. You know, on a personal note, I have done everything I can to have it all, and will continue to do so. And I think, personally, that is something probably most of us will do. But when we're talking about something, and whether we mandate something, or whether something becomes available to everybody, I suppose we just do need to look at the range and what that's being shared and who that's with. And pressure. And I noticed that I love the perfume. I think it's oh so pressurised. And actually, there is so much pressure on women, and so much pressure on the women I work with, to be like everybody else, to feel that, yes, of course, why can't they parent? Why can't they have a child and keep a child? What makes it, you know, it's as if that's a right, or is it actually something that is the only way to be fulfilled, is if you can have those things? Whereas many people make choices not to, for very different reasons, not just because they're infertile or because they're not able to care for children. It may be a very proactive choice. So we spend a lot of time in that pause with our women, using that time to help them recognise that there are other aspects to them as a woman that they can work on and focus on that can still give them fulfilment and feeling sort of self-confidence and good about themselves. So I thought I'd talk a little about who these women are, actually, because you might think, well, they obviously can't care for their children, and the fact there's 70,000 children in care, well, they're in care and they're getting good care. But actually, those children who are in care will make up the biggest population of women who go on to have their children removed in the future. So our project's about breaking cycles, about destructive cycles that results in these patterns. But those women, which this project started in Hackney, and again, I mean, my background was very much child protection, and our project is actually focused on outcomes for children. And we very much work with women and recognising they're all part of the same cycle. They will go on to have children who get removed. When they were children, something like 90% of our women were physically or sexually abused in their childhood. 50% of them were in care. They all have been involved or continue to be involved in serially domestic violent relationships. And so for them, we're trying to look at very basic needs. So in that window where we freeze and where we ask them to do other things, we're not looking at careers. We hope we will get there. We want them to have those aspirations. We're actually looking at perhaps getting them to a dentist for the first time ever. Many of our women have no teeth because they have had such complex drug and alcohol use and such poor health care. And so actually it's starting at a very difficult, different point on, I suppose, that sort of triangle, if anyone's familiar with, a kind of hierarchy of need, where you have, you know, if you haven't got somewhere to live, you're not going to be worrying about some more sort of what's important to us, and doesn't stop it being important, but about what your next career move is going to be, or whether that's the right time to do it or not. So although the debate is clearly very important, and I'm no means saying that it isn't right to have it, because I think it absolutely is, and these discussions are very, very valid, I also think it's really right to remember that there are a whole nother cohort of women who are in very difficult circumstances. But I also aspire for our women at PAWS and the women and the children they have at some point to be able to be part of these debates, and that actually they should also be part of the whole society and how we think about things.
Okay, so I've got a couple of questions that I've got ready here, and some issues have been raised. I don't know if anybody immediately has got, maybe you'd like to think about it while I ask the first question. Yes, anybody want to just sort of indicate whether they've got anything to say yet? Okay, I'll keep my eyes on you whilst we're having our chat. So, I'm going to start with one sort of fairly straightforward one. Well, none of them are straightforward, are they? One of the things that I'm looking at, talking about ageing populations. So we know that girl babies born around now are going to live until 100, well into their 90s, yeah. Possibly more and more of us will live to be 100. And in that context, and particularly talking about this sort of idea that you know, we're not ready to become parents, perhaps, and as a, I think it's another topic that nobody likes to talk about, which is menopause. As a postmenopausal woman, I'm experiencing sort of huge energy. I almost want to start my career again, and I keep thinking, oh, I'm meant to be retiring next year. Shouldn't we perhaps be thinking about encouraging people to, and we're talking men and women, to have the children if they want them at the point that they're most fertile, and restructure our society so that the career the energy we put into that is something that we do perhaps a bit later on.
Okay.
Yeah. I would just go. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I completely agree with you. With the aging society, even from the economic angle, the need to promote fertility is hugely important. We need young people to pay for pensions. There's a huge aspect to fertility. That's why we are actually starting fertility education in schools in April. It's a campaign I did last year with Nikki Morgan, which has been successful. And so fertility education in schools starts with, we start proactive. And then, of course, men and women, if they are ready when they are young, financially, physically, emotionally, they should start trying naturally. No two ways about that. But if they are not ready for the right reasons, then egg freezing is there to help. Because we need fertility. We need to promote fertility. And quite clearly, women are living late, which does mean that there's reduced fertility later in life. There are a number of issues to do with it. Need for egg donors, increased miscarriages, and concerns about reduce success rates later in as women get older. So I totally agree with you. With an aging society, we need to promote fertility. We need to promote that, which means basically those who are ready to start early so that there's a higher chance of natural conception, because there is nothing better than natural conception.
That's great. I mean, it's a very interesting idea, isn't it? Fertility is a kind of economic contributor and good for our whole society. Carly, I'm sure you've got something to say on this topic.
I think... you know, there's a lot of, although we know women having children later on in life, I think for a lot of women, especially when having their children, say, in their 40s and beyond, I don't think that was ever really the intention for a lot of women. I don't think women choose to have children later on in life. Lots of research shows that women don't choose to delay motherhood, but it's kind of life unfolds and happens that way. The women I speak to, they would say how they feel their life has just gone off track, that life has kind of taken a different course to what they expected. And none of the women I interviewed, they said they didn't want to engage with egg freezing technology, they didn't want to need it, but they made use of it because their fertility was declining. So whilst I think the idea of encouraging women to have children earlier on would prevent a lot of women from experiencing the pains of infertility, the pains of undergoing egg freezing, the way the society is set up, it isn't really suitable for women to have children any earlier if they want to get in line these certain preconditions, as I call them, these certain ideals, in things such as finishing their education, getting their first job in a professional role. These sorts of things are very difficult for women to achieve any earlier. And so whilst I think it's admirable to try and encourage women to give them this fertility education, you can be informed up to the nose, but you may not be able to make any decisions any differently as a result of that knowledge. It's powerful to have it, but it might not lead to any further change.
Right, okay. I don't know if you want to say
about that. Just a little bit, because again, it feels such a contrast to, I spend my whole time trying to work on campaigns and with young people trying to stop them having babies too early. And actually, a child, if you have a child before you're 20, the risk, and again, this is within the context that I work, the risk of having a child removed, I mean, being caught in the cycle that I work in and being one of these 70,000 children being in care is way higher. So for us, maturity, you know, emotional maturity is a key aspect to being good parents. And actually waiting, and for people who've had quite damaged childhoods, they have far better chance if they have a natural maturation until more likely their early 30s. Now, that may well not be so good for their fertility, but it's certainly more likely they will be able to keep in care for that child. So I think, you know, it just shows how...
It's the collide, isn't it, really, between the right time for motherhood biologically, physiologically, and the right time for motherhood psychologically, emotionally, socially, these sorts of things. And it's the fact that they are set at different times.
Yeah. I mean, we have a trend we call life stage delay, which I think is very much... But that, it just sort of struck me that we could kind of reorient... You know, we're in a process of trying to make a better society in terms of making work more equal for women, better work-life balance. And actually, again, I think the longevity argument is important, that we actually think about how we, maybe having it all is something you do across the course of your life, rather than trying to cram it all in together, at having career success, babies and everything else in your 30s, feeling, I think, probably quite exhausted by the time you're 40. And then, you know, whatever, it just depends on that sort of idea that you can achieve things at different points.
Yes, having it all but not at the same time.
We've got a question. Could you say who you are and your question is?
My name is Fiona. My question's around actually the framing of this broad question, can women have it all, and whether that is still the most relevant way to look at it. So it does feel like to me there's this very small window of time where all these factors, having your career, maybe being more financially stable and still having sufficient fertility, that natural birth and child rearing is easy enough. And that window is probably only about 7 or 8 years, which in the context of life is a really small period of time, and does feel like it creates this natural inequality between the genders. On the other hand, I'd also argue that men don't have it all at the moment because they cannot experience motherhood. There's still a lot of pressure in society for men to be the breadwinners. If men ask for 6 months paternity leave off work, I think there's still a lot of anxiety around the way that that impacts their careers and all the impression that gives. And I'm wondering if actually for better gender equality, should the question not be, can society have it all, and focusing on how do we make things equal across the genders in terms of breaking down the barriers of men being more involved in home life as well, because that creates more opportunity for women. On the question of whether or not you should freeze eggs, I think it's for me very much, yes, that opportunity should be there, because it just creates that 8-year window suddenly has a much broader timeline and it just gives much greater opportunity.
Great, thank you. I mean, there's some really good points there. I mean, you've also sort of brought to the fore something that Kylie mentioned, which was very much around bringing men into the argument, which I think in any sort of future settlement has to be important. So I don't know if you want to take it in turns to address that sort of thought.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point made there, actually, and I completely agree. Can women have it all? Can men have it all? No, they can't have babies. So really, I think in some ways, but you are right. I mean, look, we have got nations like Scandinavian nations we could take look to, particularly when it comes to paternity leave, and the participation of men in gender equality is huge. And these countries rate high up in the top 5, even when it comes to life, quality of life, other than the economic ones in some ways. So I think there are campaigns now, particularly He for She, look that up, from the UN Women's, which is really promoting men participating in women's. And I think having it all means different to different people. We need to look at it in a rounded way, but certainly sitting here about fertility, egg freezing is one thing that women, it takes the pressure off relationships, it takes the pressure off, gives them space to achieve things while they are not ready. But yes, there needs to be a bigger debate at a government level, at a policy level, no two ways about that.
I think you're very right about this, in a really narrow window of time which women face, and about how egg freezing can have the potential to widen this window. But of course, whilst Nugita was saying that the success rates of egg freezing is rising, the success rates are still pretty low. And whilst there are, you know, some really good countries such as, you know, Spain and Italy are getting some great results with egg freezing, those results aren't being replicated in the UK by kind of your local fertility clinic, as far as we know. The point you made about men and kind of the fact that men still experience inequalities, for example, feel like being judged or under pressure to not engage in paternity leave, these are very significant things which I think is going to take some time to address as it becomes more normalised where women are taking paternity leave. I work in academia, and I know several colleagues of mine whose partners are taking paternity leave in the liberal kind of realms of academia. This is really acceptable. But for a colleague of mine who works, he's an engineer, apprentice engineer, he talked about how he wouldn't be able to take paternity leave at that in that extent, about how he would be judged for that. The other point I wanted to make was about how we have this wonderful installation here which is able to show us the decline of women's fertility, and it's such a powerful image as well. I think it's great. And the problem is that whilst women, some women know about fertility decline, men, because they don't suffer it, sometimes still don't know about it. And lots of research shows that men are not aware of age-related fertility decline and don't factor this into their decision-making when it comes to finding a partner or pursuing parenthood. And that's what I found in my research, very much so.
Yeah. One of the things that I was very struck when Sophie was talking was around this whole idea of what having children represents to women. And this sort of idea that you can't be fulfilled if you don't have children for a lot of women. And also, I suppose, at the opposite end of the scale, I'm just really fascinated by the sort of this urge that your women have to have babies that they can't look after. What does it represent? It is our biology, and we've had some interesting terms. You know, you talk about biological inequality. Of course, men can't have babies, but you know, there's a sort of it's got a kind of symbolic purpose in our lives. So I mean, what you thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, something that we've done a lot of looking, and the kind of research, sort of very much qualitatively looking and talking to the women to try and understand. Why, when you know you're in a pattern where you may have had up to 10 children removed, why would you keep doing this thing, which is probably one of the most traumatic events? It doesn't matter what issues you're suffering, whether you're even under influence of drugs and alcohol, having a child removed, and I'm sure for every one, is the most traumatic event for these women. And one of the things we found from talking with them is what that actually represents. And you realise so much is built into the idea of what this child is going to do. It's going to make their relationship. It's going to help them stop using drugs. It's going to be this one thing that crystallises their plan to change things and move on. But also, it's what it represents for their loss of childhood. And actually, their lack of a relationship and love. So they think this thing is going to come along and going to do that thing that we all kind of hope is going to love us unconditionally and be really easy and make life feel so much better. And of course the reality isn't like that, because although it is wonderful, it's very hard work and it's very challenging and difficult. So when we work with the women over the period, and they work with us for about 18 months, and during that time they will use contraception so they don't get pregnant, so they can focus on other aspects. Quite a few of them have got to that point. One spoke to me recently about it, who'd had 10 children removed, and said, I don't think it was really a baby now that was actually the thing I wanted, and that she made a decision that she didn't want to go on trying to have children. So I do think there's something about pressure and that belief that, something's going to make things better. I'm not saying having children isn't wonderful, but it's just recognising that.
Interesting.
Could I just clarify one point on the success of egg freezing that Kylie indicated? The big studies and the work, the scientific data, have actually come from Spain and Italy. We can't reproduce these success rates in the UK. The problem is this. Our regulator, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, the success rates they publish at the moment include slow freezing. So, 9 years ago, I myself stood on a public platform and opposed egg freezing in that sense because of slow freezing. Now, we have 9 out of eggs that can survive the fast freezing method. So it's a game changer. So in the UK, we can reproduce this. We just have got the average age of the woman who is freezing eggs in my clinic is 38.5. There are women in early 30s, early 40s coming to freeze. So we need to change that game to get women earlier. So the data is real, the data can be reproduced, we just haven't had women under 35 coming, freezing and using them. And so that data is reproducible. So we are looking at success, quite significant, and success of fresh and frozen egg is the same for the age of the woman.
Right, okay.
I suppose it's so hard though, because women who go to fertility clinics now are going to be provided information about how successful or potentially successful freezing their eggs are going to be. But we still don't have the information to tell a 28-year-old your success rate is going to be this and a 38-year-old your success rate is going to be that. So these women are still going into this without all of the information at this stage. Because of the very nature of egg freezing, the time delays. We've got to wait for these women to come back, if they do come back, to see how successful they are.
Yeah, so we've got some time. Yes, there's a lady there. Could you?
Yeah, I'm Lika. And I was wondering, if you look at this wall, would you maybe then pose that there should be a government program that freezes all 12-year-old women's eggs as a precaution to at least save the stress of women to already start deciding on fertility in their 20s and early 30s?
I think the problem with egg freezing, and I'm framing it as a problem, I'm talking about everything as a negative way, although I do think it can be a wonderful technology. But I think in part the problem of it is that we provide women this opportunity to freeze eggs, or if women who can afford it, to freeze their eggs. And we could say, you know, perhaps we should offer it to all women when they turn 21, 25, these sorts of things. The thing is, trying to get women to freeze their eggs earlier than 38, the average age women in my research were 38 when they froze their eggs, is so very difficult. Because women freeze their eggs because their life hasn't turned out the way they planned. They haven't met that partner and settled down, got married and had children. But how can we get a 28-year-old, I'm 28, to think, right, you know, your life may not turn out that way. Everyone hopes that their fairy tale is going to pan out the way it does. It's trying to get women to think that it's not, to engage in this technology earlier. And that's the problem. How do you engage women to engage in egg freezing at that time, especially given the fact that it is expensive and that it is not risk-free? I know that you're very much an advocate of natural IVF. Ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome is one of the outcomes of ovarian stimulation through IVF and egg freezing. And whilst the risk of OHSS is very, very low, all of the women I spoke to had some kind of side effects. They weren't hospitalised, but they had very significant side effects, and physical experience of doing egg freezing was painful. It was emotionally painful and physically painful for these women.
I feel I need to address that because ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome free IVF is possible now because we have changed the drugs. We actually have changed the drugs. I'm not talking about natural IVF. I'm talking about stimulated IVF in natural cycle using a different trigger called the analog, which is what has eliminated the OHSS. Mm-hmm. So it is something that we are very proud of and something that is here to stay. Of course, I'm surprised to see that 12-year-old, and I think it was just visually to make it powerful. But we are looking at 30, you know, women to consider freezing it in their early 30s. Something around that, if they are not ready to have a family naturally. But the message is always try naturally in your early 30s or late 20s if you are ready.
So I think it's great to hear about the latest science because obviously that's shifting the whole time. If we haven't got any more questions, I thought we'd have a bit of audience participation now because we did do this research. And what's so interesting, Sarah sitting here at the front, was that the idea of this project came about because I think it was Apple and Facebook were offering egg freezing as a corporate benefit. And again, there's a whole question about, you know, should we be encouraging workplaces that are so frenetic that people can't stop to, you know, live their lives in any other way? Should that be encouraged? So we asked the question, should egg freezing be a corporate benefit? So I'd just be interested to see who thinks that that might be a good idea, just to compare you with the... You're obviously not a representative sample of the UK population, right? But who actually thinks that corporate benefit might be a good one? Yeah, that's about national average. It's 16% of the population thought that, but 37% of 18 to 24-year-olds, okay? Now, what about this idea? I'm absolutely struck by this whole thing around, people not feeling ready to have children. I mean, again, back to longevity, back to life stage delay, back to the fact people, I think it's something like 30% of young men are living at home until they're 34 now, because, for all sorts of reasons. Of course, you know, the fact that 50% of people are going into tertiary education, which means you acquire debts, you end up going back home, you can't afford to buy your own homes, all the rest of it. Everything is getting delayed. But this idea that there might be women in their early 30s, the people that you were talking to, with a partner in a committed relationship, not feeling that that their male partner doesn't feel ready to become a parent. I don't know if they don't feel either ready to become a parent. But what proportion of people here think that that is an acceptable reason to think of freezing your eggs? Because the challenge of finding the right partner is such that... that freezing your eggs is acceptable. Actually, you're quite typical. 82% of our sample thought that was more acceptable than being a corporate benefit. And then there was a more general one, which was just about gaining control. Egg freezing as a way of gaining control over your life. So who thinks that's a one that they would give support to? Yeah, that's quite high. So what we got in our research, 59%, this is where the age differences really showed up, 59% of 18 to 24-year-olds, and only 22% of people over 55 thought that would find it so acceptable. So we've got a whole kind of range of different attitudes in the population. Any other sort of questions and points you want to put to our esteemed panel? Yeah, Sarah.
So one of the things that's really surprised me in this project is the amount this week of couples who we've had through the door who have been interested in freezing her eggs. And I was really struck by that. Couples who are in their early 30s, who are at what you would consider exactly the right place and point in order to just go for it naturally, and who had all sorts of reasons around exactly the ones we have here about career, being more financially sustainable, just not being ready. And so I suppose one of the things that I would worry about is, does a kind of more commonplace use of egg freezing really encourage delay? Does it sort of make us feel that we have options where really one should be looking at kind of more societal change? Does it kind of encourage a behaviour of delay that needn't be there?
Kylie, maybe you start with that one.
I think that if we are talking on the basis that egg freezing works, and that not only the freezing but then the fertilisation and all that, you know, pans out and we have a healthy child, then the notion that, you know, that egg freezing is encouraging people to delay further, perhaps. But this is why the kind of just the having of the technology can be very difficult for people to resist. That's what shocked me in my research. One of the biggest reasons why women froze eggs in my research was because they didn't want to look back and regret not doing it. And that's when egg freezing poses what I think is kind of like a, you know, it's a very sharp word to use, but kind of a coercive offer. Make use of it now or you're going to regret it, and you're going to blame yourself, and you will be right to blame yourself later on. And so that's why there is that concern I have about egg freezing, that people such as these couples making use of it saying, well, if we hadn't done it, then we may not be able to have children in the future. I think that's a problem where if egg freezing does become very mainstream, it'd be difficult to resist, just like IVF now. Mm. The people who can't conceive, people say, oh, have you gone through IVF? People say no, and I say, well, you're probably not really committed to becoming a parent. And it's the same thing with egg freezing. It's something that women feel kind of compelled to engage in because of what it can potentially offer, whether it offers it in reality or not. Again, it's a separate issue.
Great, Sophie?
Yeah, no, just really interested in all the discussion, talking about egg freezing, which ultimately was adults and children, that we haven't had any discussion about the impact on children. Mm-hmm. And what is it in their interest to be able to be chosen, sort of a population where everyone starts having their children when they're older? I'm not actually saying position, because maybe if we're all going to live longer, that's fine. But I think it would be interesting to know what research has been done, not around the health of the baby having been from a frozen egg, I think that's probably known. But actually socially, what research is happening, rather than thinking about from women having it all, is us this desire to have it all having an impact on the next generation? And actually, will they therefore make it harder for them to have it all?
We've got somebody from the audience who wants to join in on that point too, I think. Yes.
Well, I was going to say, as a grandmother and having to do childcare, if my children had their children considerably later, it would be extremely difficult to do the childcare that they would also require. Yeah. So, you know, and I think there's also quite a lot of evidence that children in school feel embarrassed if they have very old parents.
Thank you for making that contribution. Grandparenting is an important topic as well, I think.
Yes, of course there are studies about health of children, born through following egg freezing and thawing, which seems to be absolutely fine. There is no increased abnormality or health problems in children born from frozen eggs compared to naturally conceived. Mm-hmm. But of course, the social studies, psychosocial studies, are not there yet. Okay, so of course they'll be done. The field is not irresponsible. The field is very responsible. Those studies will be done. But all I am saying is, when it comes to, egg freezing, what is important for us is to have such sessions and to give the right information. And the right information is to educate about fertility, to prevent infertility, to promote natural fertility, and where it is needed, to use egg freezing with the latest technology, with the modern methods, to give the best success. That is the message. And we cannot go away from that message, which is why I think technological solutions are there. But this is a technological solution, in my view, to address inequality, to address their economy to address everything else that goes with fertility decline in women. So I think we really need to give the right information, do surveys from time to time to make sure we have given the right information, it's gone down in the right way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Sophie wants to come back on that.
The only final slight challenge on that is I would just question whether they will be there, those studies, because what I can see is the focus is very much about ourselves and you know, whether we can have it all. And I'd question, firstly, actually, whether it's having that all is always that great. Maybe it isn't. But actually, I don't think the studies, what I see is when you try and get information and longitudinal studies in relation to social impact on children, whether it be from being in care or from these studies, the focus is not there. And actually, I think we've reflected that
yeah.
in conversations.
I think that's very interesting. One of the points that came out when I was analysing the research and writing that paper was sort of related to this in a way, because I was also thinking about gay people and non-typical families, of which
yes.
there's a growing proportion and a growing acceptance. And yet, and I think, Kylie, you use the term the fairy tale. You know, we're all sort of, there seems to still be this very strong pursuit of this sort of idealised relationship with the children and all the rest of it, promoted by, you could say, Hollywood, promulgated by all sorts of images and stereotypes that we have in our society. And yet there's actually only 50% of children now live in what is a typical traditional
yes,
family
yes.
with two married parents and the rest of it.
I mean,
so I think this is kind of opening up, and I think it's a really good point that we actually look at it from everybody's point of view.
Yes.
And this week in particular, there was a lot of coverage around, sorry, I'm a Guardian reader, so when I say a lot of coverage, there was a big article in the Guardian, about narcissism, and it just made me think about you know, people saying that there's a kind of an epidemic of narcissism, which is basically everybody kind of living their lives for themselves. And, you know, if we're not thinking about the impact on the children, which I know is very much your focus, Sophie, that's quite important. A lady here like to come in there, I can see.
My name is Maria. I'm actually sort of taking issue with but mainly you.
Good, excellent. We've got three minutes left.
It's a question of addressing the so-called inequality. It's the inequality for those of women who are actually well enough to afford this, because it's not just freezing the egg, it's also then storing the egg and then going back to the IVF clinic and getting this egg fertilized and implanted.
Yeah.
So the cost is for those. And but what I would like to say to you, because that was actually the main point I wanted to make, is I get the feeling that there is this sort of intention to have the perfect everything in life. And I'm obviously one of the older people, if you can't see me, but I'm one of the older people. I'm not a grandmother yet, but one of the older people. We didn't have this sort of perfection or this aim that we could have this idealized world before. People now want the perfect partner, the perfect economic circumstances, the perfect absolutely everything. And what worries me is when you then delay pregnancy by that long, will you then also want the perfect child? So you want to remove absolutely every problem, because we have the facilities to have PGD. So you already pay for IVF, and you want to remove anything that could potentially be wrong with our baby. You have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and you have your perfect child with whatever in America seemingly seems to be the blue-eyed child with the blonde hair, and it has to be tall, it has to be musical and everything else. Is there not this danger, because we've now just had the HFEA also authorize the first CRISPR, not just the mitochondria, which is, you know, acceptable because that's a horrendous disease, but we've got CRISPR, we've got gene editing, so we can actually change the child. So, you know, this is all in pursuit of this perfection, which does not actually exist in real life.
Well, it's really not designer babies we are creating. I think one or two things I want to address. The cost you mentioned, which is very important. We can't ignore the cost of egg freezing here. So what we have to do now is to try and reduce the cost to make it accessible while we do not have any public funding. And I have to say that at least two or three times a month, we have parents and grandparents bringing, you know, coming to pay for egg freezing, because, you know, having a child, having a grandchild is equally important. So we have got parents and grandparents paying for egg freezing, okay? So that's happening within the family. We are talking about employers paying for it. And eventually there is a case to be made when we have our UK clean data for partial public funding. So I do not ignore that at all. I totally agree with you. I am somebody who deeply cares about cost and social equality, and I've said that already in my talk. But I don't think we are looking at a perfect designer baby. Our regulator is quite responsible from that perspective. We are not the US. We are not doing PGD for other reasons. PGD is only for medical.
Not at the moment, but we're talking in maybe 10, 15, 20 years, because we're aiming towards perfection. Everybody's wanting something more perfect. That maybe this is something which could happen. And this would be a sort of a dangerous thing to happen.
I think we're going to, sadly, and thank you for your that. I think we can carry on, but we have more or less got to the end of our hour. I think you've brought it to a really interesting place, because I think having it all is about, you know, trying to get the most out of life, and maybe tipping over to this idea of a kind of perfect world that we might want to live in. And we have another trend we call performative perfection, which is all about how increasingly people are trying to create an image of themselves, which they both project externally and in the way that they live their lives, which is, you know, just becomes more and more of a pressure. So I think something like 56% of people we surveyed said they'd like to be more like their profile on Facebook. You know? So it's kind of like, who are we? What's really important to us? And getting clear about that. So I'm going to let is there anything else anybody wants to say? Do you feel you've had your... we've had some really different perspectives here, and absolutely fascinating. I don't think we can come to an answer. Are you sort of satisfied with what you said so far, or do you just want to? I think we can see how passionate Geeta is.
I know I've put forward a critical perspective, because I am critical. But I've seen babies born through egg freezing. One of my participants who's kept in touch with me has had two sets of twins through egg freezing, and she must be in her, well, anyway. And it's been great to see those things. She shared pictures of me, and I think, you know, egg freezing can do this wonderful thing. There's just these other issues we have when we talk about it, and not just see it as potentially wonderful.
Yeah, and those are kind of big ethical, I mean, that's why it's such a great debate, isn't it? Because it's, you know, brings to the fore all these big sort of ethical issues and a sort of broad perspective about what our lives are about, and also for women, you know, how can we not be disadvantaged by our biology, which I think is an interesting concept which I hadn't really thought about before. Anyway, I'd like you to put your hands together and thank our panel. And thank you very much.
Listen to all of our talks and find out more information at time-less.org.